From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Film historian Scott Eyman joins us this week. He's the author of the great biography of John Ford called Print the Legend, and has also written about Ernst Lubitsch, Mary Pickford, Louis B. Mayer, and Cecil B. DeMille. Now he's turned his considerable talent to filling in one of the most serious gaps in the film history bookshelf. John Wayne, Life and Legend, is the definitive biography of the actor, director, and movie star. Scott Eyman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, during John Wayne's career, he was never as highly regarded as Gable or Bogart or Spencer Tracy, but younger people today, they all know Wayne and they've never heard of those others.
Yeah, well, Wayne was extremely fortunate in his collaborators. Adopting John Ford as his father figure and mentor. If Bogart or Clark Gable had been lucky enough to make 16 or 17 films with John Ford, I think many more people would be aware of who they are in the 21st century. Because I mean, actors, movie stars tend to be locked into their own generation, you know, for psychological reasons as well as standards of beauty and or handsomeness. Because those change all the time, just like any other fashion standards change. And what 1945 considered breathtaking, 2014 could just shrug over, and vice versa. But John Ford doesn't go away. Films like Stagecoach and Fort Apache and The Searchers and Liberty Valance and The Quiet Man provoked conversation when they were released, and they still provoke conversation. So in that sense, Wayne was particularly lucky in a sense, it wasn't only his luck. I mean, he also made great films for Howard Hawks, great films for Henry Hathaway. He excelled with a number of top ranked directors, so he more than carried his own weight.
Do you think his focus as an actor was maybe more narrow than it needed to be? I mean, both Henry Fonda, for instance, and Jimmy Stewart made pictures with Hitchcock that were great. It would have been interesting if Duke and Hitchcock had gotten together.
Yeah, I don't know. It would have worked well. It would have been one of those awkward things, like with Hitchcock and Paul Newman, or Hitchcock and Gregory Peck. There were certain actors that just weren't on his wavelength, which is not unusual. I mean, it that happens. You would think Paul Newman and Hitchcock could work together effectively, but Hitchcock didn't like Newman, and Newman didn't like Hitchcock, and the film is a dud. Wayne at one point was extremely ambitious. There's a story in the book that after Stagecoach and The Long Voyage Home, he was talking about how he wanted to play all kinds of parts. He wanted to play heavies, he wanted to play heroes, he wanted to play Sidney Carton, he wanted to do it all. And Ollie Carey, the wife of Harry Carey Sr., was sitting there and said, "You dumb SOB." And he said, "Excuse me?" Because he adored her. And Harry Carey was another father figure. He was a man in search of father figures. And Ollie Carey said, "You dumb SOB." And he said, "Excuse me?" And she says, "Look at Harry over there." And he turns and looks at Harry Carey, who's standing there. And he says, "Do you want Harry to be anything other than what he is in the movies? Do you want him to play heavies? Do you want him to, you know, do this, do that?" And he said, "Well, no, of course not." And she said, "Well, then, listen to that." She said, "The people of America have taken you into their hearts. They want you to be who you are. So be who you are. Be like Harry." You know, in other words, project that kind of quality that Harry Carey projected and that John Wayne projected. They're different kinds of qualities. Harry Carey was more rural, you know, and more bucolic and gentler. Wayne had a capacity for rage and violence that Harry Carey really didn't have as an actor. But what she was saying is, be yourself. Don't try to be what you're not. Be yourself. And he would step outside that self-imposed container for John Ford, I mean, or Hawks or Hathaway. He would play really, really nasty men for them if they asked him to. But for the pictures he produced himself, for the pictures where he was the controlling force, he tended to play it much more conservatively and much more down the middle of the fairway, to use a sports metaphor. If Hawks asked him to do something, if Ford asked him to do something, if Hathaway asked him to do something, he'd say, "Yes, sir," and he would do it, even if it was outside of his comfort zone. Other people, not necessarily.
Well, you list about 15 films at the start of John Wayne, The Life and Legend, that you think are sort of the essentials. But I want to ask about some of the 150 other films. Olive Films has been releasing a lot of Blu-rays of older films that I guess the studios aren't interested in putting out. And they include a number of films that Wayne made during his tenure on Poverty Row. Which of those pre-Stagecoach pictures do you think are worthwhile?
Well, I mean, they're interesting in that they're, most of the pictures he made at Republican Monogram were called series westerns. And that means they would be made in blocks of six or eight and sold as a block to exhibitors. So they weren't being made as individual efforts. They were being made in the same way the TV episodes are made today, where you contract for 10 or 15 or 20, and they're made one right after the other. And the object is not necessarily to make a killer TV episode. The object is to make a, is to present a kind of continuum of drama and character that are pleasing to the audience. It's much more of a commercial enterprise than making an individual picture for an individual director at an individual studio. And as I said, it's much more analogous to modern television. And Wayne knew that. And when he worked with Ron Howard on The Shootist, his last picture, he told Howard, this is what Howard told me, that he thought that the B-Westerns of the 30s that Wayne had made were analogous to all the TV shows of the 60s and 70s that Ron Howard had made, because you're on a very limited schedule. You do not go overtime. If the thing is supposed to be finished on Friday, if you work till midnight on Friday, then you work till midnight on Friday in order to get it shot. But the main thing is getting it done, and there's a certain assembly line quality to the work. And he said, but that teaches you discipline, it teaches you craft, it teaches you technique, because there's not always really good writing to fall back on, so you have to use other aspects to be convincing for the audience. And he told Howard that that he thought Howard's career in television was exactly analogous to his career in B-movies in the 30s. And I think there's probably a lot of truth to that, because as I said, there's an assembly line ethic at work. Some of the pictures he made at Republic there's one I like called New Frontier that's an anti-New Deal Western. It's about the government is going to come in and displace people from their town and build a dam, and the people rebel and they refuse to leave the town, and they fight off the government and they stay in the town. It's exactly the plot of Elia Kazan's Wild River, except in Kazan's Wild River the people are thrown off their land and they build the dam. And it's the only probably time anybody has ever compared a George Sherman picture to an Elia Kazan picture. I like that one. I like that picture a lot, because it's most of the plots of the B westerns are very programmatic. You know, you know 5 minutes in exactly what the rest of the hour is going to consist of, because they're made for rural audiences and kids. They weren't made for adults in New York City or Newark or Chicago. They were made for kids in Omaha and in the southern states and in Oklahoma and Texas. The market for the pictures was fairly circumscribed. So they were made for more undemanding rural audiences. So the plots are not that interesting. But every once in a while, a wild card slipped through, like New Frontier.
Did those pictures play as a second feature with major movies, or were there like two Republic B pictures as a...
It would depend on where they were playing. In a big city, they would be definitely second features. In Cleveland or Detroit or Chicago, they would be a second feature to a major picture. Down south or in Oklahoma, in Texas, New Mexico, places like that, they were the main feature. That was what people came to see. Because the Western, I talked to Robert Walker Jr., whose mother was Jennifer Jones. Uh-huh. And Robert Walker's grandfather, Jennifer Jones' father, was a guy named Phil Isley, who was a major exhibitor in Oklahoma and Texas. That's how Jennifer Jones got into the movies. Her dad picked up the phone and called Herbert Yates at Republic and said, my daughter wants to be an actress. Could you try her out? Huh. And Phil Isley had 150 theaters, and he played an awful lot of Republic pictures. So Herbert Yates had a vested interest in keeping Phil Isley happy. So Jennifer, you know, her dad bought Jennifer a train ticket, and she shows up at Republic. She made a serial. A Dick Tracy serial and a picture with Duke Wayne, and she's charming. She didn't have much to do, but she's charming, and she pops through the screen. And before you know it, David Selznick or Fox signed her up to do a Song of Bernadette, and she met David Selznick, and bingo. Yeah. And that's where Robert Walker came from, because she was married to Robert Walker at the time. But that's a typical example of where Republic Pictures played, because, you know, Phil Eisley was an archetypal Republic exhibitor.
We're talking with Scott Eyman, and his new book is called John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Of the later Republic Pictures, I've always loved The Fighting Kentuckian from 1949.
Mm-hmm. Because, is that because you're an Oliver Hardy fan?
Yeah, because Oliver Hardy's in there. And I love I love that scene where you talk about Duke kind of at the feet of Babe Hardy listening to Hardy spin tales of the silent days.
Yeah, yeah, on the train where they're doing What Price Glory. Yeah.
Wayne had a lot of respect for Oliver Hardy?
Wayne was a movie buff. That's one of the things that gave me so much pleasure in researching and talking to his friends and coworkers. In the 70s, somebody asked him to make a list of his five favorite movies of all time. And The Quiet Man was on there. And of all pictures, Rex Ingram's The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which he saw in Glendale, California when he was, he would have been 15. And he loved it. He went back several times to see it. And he was always faithful to those great silent pictures. That's where he saw Harry Carey for the first time, mm-hmm. in silent movies, you know. And occasionally, you know, sometimes the men that he saw in the movies in Glendale lived up to their image as Harry Carey did. Other times they didn't, as with Tom Mix, who basically blew him off when he went to work at Fox, when Wayne went to work at Fox. Tom Mix blew him off, and he was a huge admirer of Tom Mix from watching Tom Mix westerns in Glendale.
I want to talk a little bit about horses. John Wayne, he's a great rider. He's a beautiful rider, and one mm-hmm. of my favorite photos in John Wayne, The Life and Legend, is this picture of Wayne, and he's on the set of The Big Trail, and he's like sitting side saddle on his horse. It's like he's sitting.
Oh yeah.
It's like he's sitting on a couch. The way he's just so comfortable.
Right. Totally at ease. Totally at ease. Yeah.
And you only talk about horses briefly in the book, and once you.
I had three pages that cut out. I literally had three pages about in the 60s about this horse he rode, and then this other horse he rode, and which were his favorite horses to ride. And then there was the horse in El Dorado that's way too small for him, and it looks like the horse is going to collapse beneath him. And all I had three pages in the in my draft, and I was editing, and the book is 640 pages of text.
Well, those were the three pages I was looking for, Scott.
And those that I cut them because I said to myself, how many people are going to care about his horse? And I didn't know about this guy in Santa Cruz. I apologize. I totally apologize. But I literally had three pages about it.
Because you say in the book where Duke says that he wouldn't ride unless he was being paid, but I don't believe him necessarily, because he says a lot of things that he doesn't actually mean, right?
Well, yeah, but he did not horseback ride for a hobby. I mean, he never owned a horse of his own, for instance. Roy Rogers owned Trigger. Gene Autry owned Champion. William Boyd owned Hopalong Cassidy's horse's name?
Not telling
help me out. Anyway, no, that was
Tom Mix's.
But anyway, but all those guys owned their horses, and they adored those horses, and they took really, really good care of those horses. Because that's their co-star, really. Because actors come and go in westerns, but you know your horse is part of your identity as a cowboy star. Wayne never owned his own horse. There were certain horses he would say, yeah, that one, but he never owned a horse of his own. He never went horseback riding on his day off, which would be like, let's face it, a mailman taking a walk on his day off. Why would he want to do that? Because he's on a horse probably 4 months a year. You know, it just wasn't his favorite thing. Horses were not his favorite thing. He thought horses were on the dumb side, actually. He really didn't. He was a dog guy. He was a dog man. He loved dogs. He had dogs most of his life. But horses were not his favorite beast.
And he co-starred with Lassie once.
Yes, he did, in Hondo. In Hondo. And Lassie got kidnapped. The enterprising natives of Camargo, Mexico, kidnapped Lassie. Because they figured they couldn't make the best of the movie without him, and they were right. So they had to ransom Lassie. I'm sure Red Weatherwax was absolutely panicked.
That was a good scheme.
Pardon?
That was a good money-making scheme.
Oh, it was a fabulous money-making scheme. Don't try to kidnap an actor. Kidnap the dog that's in half the movie. Then they'll absolutely panic, because you know you can't get another a trained dog down there so easily. But they disguised it so it didn't look like Lassie. You know, the dog is kind of painted with some kind of... and he's caked with mud, so he doesn't really look like Lassie, but it is Lassie.
My mom used to hate John Wayne because of his politics, and I used to argue with her that it really didn't matter, you know, because he's such a great actor. But you know, actually now I find myself with similar feelings. Like, I don't think I ever want to see a Mel Gibson movie or an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. So I guess I kind of understand the people who reacted to Wayne because of his politics. But but in your book, Wayne's politics are sometimes surprisingly nuanced.
Well, yeah, he was fairly self-aware. I mean, he was not. He wanted to be an actor. He wanted to be a movie star. He always told people he didn't, but that was a lie. He was a blue-collar kid, and he was a jock. And a blue-collar jock in the early 20th century is not going to embrace the craft of acting. It's not a suitable job, a suitable occupation for an adult, you know, for an adult male. So he always pretended that he kind of backed into it, and he wasn't really something he was interested in. It's a total lie. He was in the drama club in high school. He acted on stage in high school. When he got to Fox as a prop guy, he started pestering people to give him acting jobs. I mean, he wanted to be an actor. His politics, he was extremely conservative, and he was generally a supporter of the most conservative candidate in the race. In 1952, for instance, he was for Robert Taft. Taft did not get the nomination. Dwight Eisenhower got the nomination. So he grudgingly supported Dwight Eisenhower, even though Eisenhower was a little squishy, soft for him. In 64, he was a Barry Goldwater guy. A big Reagan guy. But on the other hand, there's this wonderful letter I quote in the book where he calls Ronald Reagan a damn liar. This is before he got elected president, yeah. In my hand. But he calls Reagan a damn liar, private letter to Reagan where he calls him a damn liar, because he believed Reagan was lying about the Panama Canal Treaty. There was a big brouhaha in the 70s about whether or not we should give the canal back to the Panamanians, even though we'd signed a treaty with a date certain that at which point it would, you know, be handed over to the Panamanians. But a lot of the conservatives wanted to hold on to it because, A, we paid for it, and, B, it was ours, or we thought it was, and possession is nine-tenths of the law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said we had to give it back, that our word was our bond, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but a lot of conservatives were up in arms. They thought this Jimmy Carter was being, you know, a wimpy liberal. And Wayne, you know, absolutely supported giving the canal back to the Panamanians. Now, of course, he had a lot of friends in Panama, so he was not acting purely out of high moral principle. He had friends there, and this would redound to the benefit of the country, obviously, because it would put a lot more money in their coffers as opposed to money in our coffers. But yeah, he would go off the reservation on where he thought moral principle was involved.
Well, he didn't have anything to gain from writing a letter to President Kennedy telling him that he liked his inaugural address, for instance.
No. And he was always the difference between a conservative like Wayne and so much of modern conservatism is that with Wayne, the personal was always much more important than the political. If he liked you, if he thought you were a straight guy, he didn't care how liberal you were. He really didn't. He worked very effectively with flaming liberals like Haskell Wexler, a great cameraman who went to Hanoi with Jane Fonda. Now, it doesn't get more liberal than that. And he and Wexler worked very well together. Orson Welles adored him. Orson Welles said he was had the finest manners of any man he ever met in Hollywood, and he thought he was a great guy. And Welles also was a serious FDR New Deal liberal. But you know, if Wayne would table all the political stuff if he thought you were a good person, a good human being. So many modern people on either side of the political fence don't do that. You know, if you're a liberal and this guy's a conservative, you know, you can barely tolerate him, and you can't get out of the room fast enough, and vice versa. It wasn't like that with Wayne. Of course, it's a different time as well.
He was more cultured and well-read than people might believe.
Oh yeah, far more so. Far more so. When I interviewed him in 1972, I was a kid. I was 21 years old, and he liked me fine. I mean, he sat with me for 90 minutes at CBS. He was doing a TV special, and you know, they weren't ready for him. So he was happily talking movies with me, and I asked him about Ford's Long Voyage Home. You know, which is based on four Eugene O'Neill one-act plays. And I asked him if he'd read the O'Neill plays before he shot the film. And as soon as it was out of my mouth, I wanted to kind of take it back, you know, because it sounded like I thought he was stupid. And I knew it, but I was gonna. I didn't know what to, how to take it back. And he kind of looked at me, and I think he was gauging whether or not I was being a smartass. And he saw that I wasn't. That it, I was just a dumb kid. And finally, he just sighed and said, "I'd been to college. I'd read O'Neill." And that was it. And it was as gentle a put down as I've ever gotten, you know, and as elegantly gentle a put down as I've ever gotten. And I knew that he knew that I had been a bit foolish, but he wasn't going to hammer me for it, you know. And but he let me know that he knew that I was foolish, but he thought I was I had goodwill, so he was going to let it go. And we continued on for another half hour after that, and it was a fine conversation. Yeah, he was extremely well-read. He read his fiction tastes, they were all over the map. I mean, he had a copy of Lolita, Nabokov's Lolita. He had all the Tolkien novels, the Lord of the Rings novels. He had a lot of 19th century fiction by Arthur Conan Doyle. His favorite, his idol was Winston Churchill, next to John Ford. And he'd read all of Churchill's books, which is a considerable undertaking, because Churchill wrote dozens and dozens of books. Because actually, that's how he made his living as a ink stained wretch. You couldn't make much money as the prime minister, not with his overhead. But he was extremely well read, and he read detective fiction. Rex Stout. He liked Rex Stout a lot. But he was very well read. He liked Oriental art. There were some very nice Oriental art pieces in his house that he picked up when he was shooting The Barbarian and the Geisha in Japan for John Huston, a man he really disliked. He was good at interior decorating. He loved to go antiquing. He liked to decorate his kids' houses. You know, when the kids moved out and got their first apartment, he'd walk in and say, okay, the TV has to go here, the couch is here, dining room goes over here, you need to put the wall stuff over here. And he would decorate their house for them. He had a good eye. Basically, he had a good eye.
We're talking with Scott Eyman, and his new book is called John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Sort of exciting hearing that story about you sitting there talking to him. What about Wayne as a director? I mean, in your book, I learned that he directed a lot of the movies that he didn't get credit for directing, and that he would sort of push the director aside.
He supervised. Yeah. He supervised the direction.
But he actually did direct two pictures, one of which, I guess, is one of the worst movies he ever made, The Green Berets.
And it's not one of his best, no.
And the other is The Alamo, which I guess now is being reassessed as a better movie than it had previously been.
Yeah, it has a lot of defenders. Not the Alamo itself, the movie. There were only 240 guys or something at the Alamo, so they didn't have a lot of defenders. I got a copy of the uncut version, which is very hard to find now, because it opened. It was a reserve seat picture, you know, downtown movie palaces. And it opened a little soft, so they immediately cut 30-35 minutes out of the picture. And it kind of altered the dynamics of the picture. And that's the version that's most commonly available, the one you see on TV on the Western Channel and all that. It's the cut version. The Roadshow version, which is a good half hour longer and differs in a lot of respects, the sound mix is different and they shifted some scenes around. It's a much better movie. It's an authentic epic as opposed to the short version, which just feels like a long Western. An overlong Western. The long one, you actually get an epic feel out of it. The only problem with The Alamo is the script, essentially, which had started. He and his friend James Edward Grant started working on it in 1947-48, and they finally shot the picture in 1960. So there were 11 and 12 years of writing and rewriting and tearing it apart and putting it back together again. And somewhere in there, James Edward Grant got tired. and just got written out, which can happen, certainly after 12 years. And I think probably they'd looked at the pages so long they couldn't see what was good anymore and what was bad. So the dialogue's not great, and oddly, there's almost no action in the first half of the picture. There's a lot of palavering, and as Wayne's daughter-in-law told me, there's so much talking going on, the Mexicans could have come over the walls and killed everybody, and nobody would have noticed. The second half of the picture is actually very good, because that's where all the action is, and it's very well directed in terms of action and scope and everything. And one of the best interviews I had in researching the book was with a guy named Robert Relye, who was the assistant director on the film. And he worked with John Sturges and William Wyler and Robert Wise, really all A-list guys, and Wayne before he even, and later on he became a producer, and he produced Bullet for Steve McQueen and Le Mans for McQueen and a number of other pictures. So he had a really interesting movie career on his own. And he told me that when it came to camera, when it came to sound, when it came to all the technical aspects of filmmaking, Wayne was as good as William Wyler or Robert Wise or John Sturges. He had absolute command of all the paraphernalia of filmmaking. He said where he fell short was in talking to actors. He could not talk to actors. And he said you cannot overlook that as something that has to be done. But he just didn't have the patience. He had a short fuse, and he didn't have a lot of patience. And he expected everybody to be able to do what he could do, which is essentially flip it on like an electric light and then flip it off when the camera stopped. And actors, some actors can do that. Most can't. They need to be jollied. They need to be caressed. They need to feel secure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he didn't have that propensity, you know. He didn't have the propensity of coddling actors. So there were problems in that regard. Some actors loved working for him. Lawrence Harvey, who plays Travis, adored him. Wayne and Widmark, however, had a terrible relationship. At least Widmark had a terrible relationship. Wayne liked Widmark and respected him, but Widmark couldn't stand Wayne. He thought he was a blowhard. And I think the politics got involved, too. Widmark was liberal, and of course Wayne wasn't, and I'm sure there was some tension there. And Wayne could overlook it, but Widmark couldn't.
I think my favorite scene in your book is when John Ford is sitting in on the set of The Alamo, and I think it's a scene that he's doing with Richard Widmark, right? He says, what did you think of the scene? And Widmark said it was good, and Ford tells him to reshoot it. And he says, well, what's wrong with it, Pappy? And Ford said, it's no damn good.
And they reshot it. Yeah.
Talking about talking to actors. Ford really knew how to do that.
Well, yeah, but that was, you know, when you're John Ford, you can say things like that. You know, he's got four Oscars. He's got five Oscars, and he's John Ford, and he's got this long list of great pictures. So he's got this massive load of authority backing him up, you know. Somebody else without those kinds of credentials, not necessarily. Can't get away with that.
We're talking to Scott Eyman, and his new book is called John Wayne, Life and Legend. So let's just talk about the death of the Western. You know, you give a couple of interesting theories about why the Western died out in your book, but I don't know, they don't make a whole lot of sense. Like somebody said, well, there's, you know, it was Burt Kennedy and those guys who were making Western after Western, and people just got tired of them. But the Western grew in popularity when the Republic pictures were turning out Western after Western after Western. So that one doesn't really hold. And the fact that some of the Westerns were bad doesn't make sense either, because all those Republicans...
Some of the Westerns were always bad.
Right.
No, yeah, I think my gut, and there have been various theories floated about this. I think there are two contributing factors. If you look at, in the 50s and 60s, the Western was the single most popular genre on television. There were literally dozens of Westerns on every year on all three networks. Whether it was Gunsmoke or Have Gun Will Travel or Maverick, I mean, literally there were dozens between the three networks. And some were more successful. And that went on into the 70s with shows like Bonanza and The Big Valley, which are Westerns. They're different kinds of Westerns, but they're still Westerns. I think that those 20 years, essentially, of a plethora of Westerns, plus the Westerns that were being done in the movies, I think it was kind of overkill. And I think for the audience that loved them, that was fine. But for the audience that didn't love them, they just were totally inundated and drowned in Westerns. And I think they got alienated by it. And then Westerns went into decline in the 70s, beginning in the 70s. And I think Vietnam had something to do with that. I think because the Western is implicitly a violent genre. 95% of Westerns are implicitly violent. And there was a revulsion against the idea of the guy on the horse setting things right and then leaving, you know, all of which could be a metaphor for Vietnam or a metaphor for what we wanted to do in Vietnam and couldn't. And I think between those two things, the inundation of Westerns in the 50s and 60s, and then the radical change in public taste that happened in the 70s, and it began in the 60s and came to fruition in the 70s. And now, you know, you've had basically 40 years where the only Westerns that get made are vanity Westerns. You know, Quentin Tarantino with Django Unchained, or The Lone Ranger, and, you know, the Costner open range, which I actually rather liked. But the only way to get a Western made is if you're coming off a couple of big hits and you've got a lot of clout and you want to make a Western. As any kind of a continuing genre, it's dead. It's absolutely dead. Because you've got probably two and a half, three generations that have grown up where the Western is seen as kind of an archaic remnant of earlier years in Hollywood. And I don't know if it ever comes back. Maybe it's like Etruscan pottery or Roman poetry. Maybe it's simply going to be locked in the 20th century. The Western is going to be locked in 20th century cinema. You know, I would love to see it come back, but I'm not optimistic.
It may also be that because you can now make a movie about anything and there's no censorship of any kind, that you don't need to have metaphorical stories where you hide from the censors by telling a story that takes place in the Old West.
Possibly, and then there's the whole thing about authenticity, the visual authenticity. A Western, you know, when they were going to make a Western, they went out to Kanab or Moab or Monument Valley or Lone Pine or whatever. They went out to the actual places where the West took place, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a certain psychological and physical authenticity that derives from that. And now what the audience wants to see is fantasy landscapes that nobody's ever seen, you know, because they don't exist anywhere on Earth, because it's all CGI. And I don't know if you actually shot a movie, a period picture, like a Western is, if you actually shot a movie without resorting to CGI, if it would be accepted. I think they need that candy-colored, tangerine-flake fantasy element in almost everything, because it exists in almost every genre now. You know, you look at a movie, and it's a cop movie, and, you know, it takes place in some urban environment, and there's 40 seconds of CGI credits on the crawl at the end. So they can't not use this stuff. And the whole foundation of the Western is actual landscapes, and the landscape is a character. And it's not a backdrop, it's a character. And Ford knew that, and Hawks knew that. The land is crucial in the way they shoot Westerns. And I don't think, you know, I just don't think that's the way modern filmmakers think particularly. And it's certainly not the way modern audiences think.
You point out in the wonderful audio commentary that you did on Stagecoach that the action being filmed, being done by real actors and stuntmen, mm-hmm. has a quality that you can never get in CGI.
Sure, sure, sure. Well, the famous stunt that Yakima Canutt does when he's climbing on the Stagecoach and he's trying to get to the horses, and Wayne shoots him and he falls under the horses in one shot, as the horses in the stagecoach pass over him, and then just to prove that it's not a fake shot, he stands up and collapses again. And you're thinking, how the hell did he do that? You know, and I explained how he did it in the John Ford book. I didn't go into it in the John Wayne book again, but that the risks that those guys take gives the film a kind of credibility that it wouldn't have if they'd resorted to obvious fakery, you know? You buy it. If they're willing to risk their lives, then I should sit here and watch this movie.
The stunt makes the movie.
Right.
Let me ask you about one more picture, The Conqueror, mm-hmm. which I guess that one hasn't really been reassessed as a good movie. It's just not a very good movie. But the kind of legend around The Conqueror is that all the people involved, Howard Hughes, Susan Hayward, Agnes mm-hmm. Moorehead, Dick Powell, and the Duke, all eventually died of cancer because the film was made on the site of nuclear tests. Is there any truth to that?
It's not out of the realm of possibility. I don't know about Dick Powell's personal habits or Agnes Moorehead's personal habits, but Wayne smoked 3 to 4 packs a day of Camels, unfiltered Camels. And I'm inclined to think that his lung cancer in 1963 probably had more to do with 3 to 4 packs a day of Camels than it did, which he'd been smoking since he was like 16, than it did with making one movie on location for 3 or 4 weeks. You know, could it have pushed it over the edge? Possible. We're never going to know. But in terms of what we know now about the effects of tar and nicotine, and the fact is, he kept smoking. When I interviewed him in his dressing room at CBS in 72, I walk in, and he's smoking a little black cigar that's about, I don't know, 5 inches long, 4 inches long.
And this, we should point out, this is after half of his lung had already been removed.
This is after he lost his lung. And I was stunned. I'm looking at the cigar, I'm looking at him, looking at the cigar, and I decided not to say anything about it, which was smart. But at this point, this 1972, he's America's most famous cancer survivor, and he's smoking a cigar. and as I found out in talking to people in doing the book, he never stopped smoking. He was either smoking a cigarette or a cigar, or for a while he was chewing tobacco. He was totally addicted. He was totally addicted, and he really couldn't stop. But then he also had, you know, he had terrible. He liked red meat. I mean, his diet was a nightmare. It was just a nightmare, and he wasn't going to change. You know, he was one of those guys. What do you say about a guy who loses a lung to cancer and keeps smoking? What do you say about that guy? It's like Mitchum. You know, Robert Mitchum on his deathbed is dying of emphysema, and he's smoking, and he's dying of emphysema, but he's still smoking. Those guys, you know, they weren't predisposed towards listening to medical sense. They lived hard. They were perfectly prepared to die hard, and they did.
Well, it's hard to believe that there has never been a great book about Wayne, but I guess I've always found that they're either fan biographies, which are unsatisfying, or highly critical biographies, which are also unsatisfying. And so, Scott Eyman, I want to thank you for writing this book, John Wayne, Life and Legend. It's really an achievement.
Well, thank you very much. And tell your mom to give him another chance.
Well, I will. I mean,
he really was a wonderful actor.
As we can see in The Searchers and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Exactly.
Well, Scott Eyman, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Scott Eyman, his new book, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.